Welcome to Motivated to Lead Podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim. Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. This week, we're going to take a look back at one of our conversations with Shane Hughes. Shane is the president of Learning as Leadership and one of the leading voices in building high-trust, high-performance cultures. He's worked with organizations such as NASA, Shell, Capital One, and Fairchild Semiconductor to transform the way their teams communicate, collaborate, and lead. He co-authored a book entitled Ego-Free Leadership, written with former Encore Capital CEO Brandon Black, which chronicles the real-world transformation of a public company executive team using learning as leadership tools. He's got some great thoughts he's going to share, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy our conversation with Shane. Well, I guess first off, Shane, can you give our listeners just a little bit of your background, a little bit of your career history?
Well, how much time do I have? I didn't expect to end up where I am. I suppose, sure. In life, and maybe to talk about my career, I should talk a little bit about my formative years, because the two connect.
Absolutely.
Well, my parents divorced when I was two, and I ended up moving a lot with a single mom. Had a brief relationship. She had a brief relationship with my stepfather that was actually quite difficult. And so, by the time I entered my teens, I actually was kind of reeling emotionally, but without knowing it. At that age, I wasn't very conscious, but I think I had been through a lot both within the home and in my peer relationships that had really affected me at a deep level. I think I had a lot of emotional pain and beliefs kind of about myself and other people that by the time I was kind of end of high school, early college had led me both to be pretty depressed and then managing that with substance abuse and I would say kind of extreme recklessness. I was never did anything actively to try to kill myself, but I did a lot of things that had they gone wrong would have led to that. And so by the time I was an undergrad at UC Berkeley, somehow in all of this, I was still managing to function in school. I got into UC Berkeley from Rhode Island and was really coming to terms with the fact that whatever I was doing was not working for me. And so I stumbled into this work that today I still teach at the age of 51. It was a nonprofit at the time that did, in essence, personal development workshops. And it just like opened the lid, Mark, on all of these things that had been going on that I didn't know how to make sense of. A lot of it, on the one hand, was slow, but on the other hand, allowed me to actually really progress on internal limiters and behaviors that I had, judgments I had of myself that I just thought were kind of permanent. And so I worked my way through college. I continued to do this work as an undergrad. And so when I graduated, and that was winter of 92, I had no money, but I also had no debt. So, the work that I was doing was actually founded by an organization in France. So I bought a one-way ticket to Paris, France, right a few months after I graduated and sort of started off as the copy boy, doing very basic stuff and sensing that whatever it had helped me grow through during my undergraduate years, the work wasn't done. And it was kind of the most meaningful thing other than my education that had an impact on me. And so it's because a long story, but in essence, I became a professional in the organization, took on different roles, continued to do a lot of work on who I was as a person, who I was as a leader, as a teammate. And I think I always thought to myself, the day I outgrow this work and I get bored with it, it's not relevant anymore, I'll go do something else. And it's really flexed with me. So as I got married, as I had kids, I use it every day with my children. It's really way more challenging to raise kids than it is to manage a team in some ways. So then in the late 90s, we ended up pivoting back from France to the US, to the US corporate market. And so then I found myself sort of involved in a startup here with a broader team, and just continue to evolve. And so in one way, I've always been in the same organization, and that's had its limitations. And, you know, there's things I don't know that I don't know because of my context. And on the other hand, what's really been interesting is because we work with all sorts of industries, you know, I've gotten fairly deep into organizations in, you know, oil and gas, real estate, finance, banking. The National Lab Network is just a fascinating, you know, place to work, NASA. So it's given me these, you know, nonprofits, academic institutions. So I've ended up having kind of a pretty broad, I guess, industry sector experience, sure, even though I've been somewhat narrow in my personal professional experience. And I'm still here, and I think there was a major pivot in my career where I had become the CEO of our organization, and for a variety of reasons felt like I could no longer continue in that role. So I actually resigned. And I will say, with pretty significant feelings of failure and inadequacy in that moment. And I don't know, I guess I had a mental model of, you know, up and out. So I'd risen to the top of the organization. I no longer wanted to be in the role. And so I started considering, okay, what are my next options? Where I've always wondered about what it would be work in different places, or should I go back to school and get an advanced degree? And I realized this work that I've been doing is kind of so deeply embedded in my DNA and how I see the world. Like, I would go back to get an advanced degree, but I think I would write my thesis on this work. And so in this moment, kind of emptiness, sprung the idea of writing Ego-Free Leadership with a close client of mine of about 7 years named Brandon Black, who ran a finance organization. And so over the next 3 years, he and I collaborated in writing this book. And I think I just decided, you know what, this is my mission, this work. This is what I have to contribute. At this point, I have so much, I guess, experience that I would be kind of ashamed to start over when I think this is what I have to offer. So since that time, I've just thrown myself back into client work with different organizations in a new way. And I'm pretty happy.
So one of our guests had suggested your book as one of the top books that she recommends to leaders, and definitely want to talk about some of the principles that you laid out in that book. And I know Brandon Black, you said, was a client, and he kind of tells his story as a CEO of an organization and trying to figure things out, and things weren't going well, and how you kind of stepped alongside to help him as far as in the process. I think a lot of our listeners are new leaders, maybe first-time CEOs, and that whole idea of ego-free leadership, and the subtitle is Ending the Unconscious Habits That Hijack Your Business. And I think a lot of times people think they see leaders and they go, oh, that's how you lead. And sometimes the leaders have a lot of ego that gets in the way. And sometimes people tend to mimic those leaders they respect, and they end up doing some of the same things. Talk a little bit about just kind of how, as you were delving into that topic, some things that you learned and then we'll dig deeper into that topic. But what were some of the first things that surprised you?
Well, first of all, I'm very grateful to Brandon for lending his story to this book, because it's not easy to write about or explore concepts that are, you know, fairly deep or subtle. Mm-hmm. And I think I was afraid of writing a kind of concept-centric book that was like heavy slogging. And so what I like about what we did honestly is that he really tells his story as a narrative. You know, it's almost like a memoir as the first time CEO. And so I really heard over the years from so many readers who have just related to him as a person and the things he was going through. So I'm very grateful for his authenticity in what he shares. And then what I tried to do is just sprinkle in, you know, so we kind of do this back and forth where he shares his story and I share a little section just to try to give concepts that are relevant. But then just when you get about, you know, you're kind of tired of listening to me, you can go back to Brandon again. And so I find it hopefully, you know, pretty engaging. And I think one of the things we try to tackle is this question you're raising, which is, wait, hold on, you need ego as a leader. And I think already we have a little bit sometimes a misconception of the different ways in which ego can manifest. So our kind of colloquial definition of ego is this quasi-constant preoccupation with my self-worth. So in any given situation, whether I'm presenting to the board, I'm managing my team, I'm alone at my desk trying to work on a strategy document, I'm in a podcast like this talking with someone, there's some part of my brain that's chirping away, evaluating, you know, mind chatter. Oh, this is good, this is bad. What does Mark think about this? You know, is he judging me? Well, am I, you know, and then, or I'm judging back in different ways. Am I competent? Am I valued? Am I intelligent? Do people respect me? And the thing is, all of this is very personalized. So what makes my ego get activated may very well be different than what makes your ego get activated or Brandon's or someone else's. And so it's a very personal thing how this shows up for us. And often it can show up in ways that we might more readily associate with ego, right? Someone who takes up a lot of space, we think wants to be the center of attention, you know, is abrasive, doesn't listen, wants to be right. But that's actually a smaller proportion of our population. I think a much bigger proportion of our leadership population and our world population are more hidden facets to ego. People who more withdraw or shut down or avoid conflict or feel victimized by other people. You know, we in that place, we feel more righteous and we're more judging that the other person is the cause. But we ourselves are actively playing a role in that dynamic through, you know, through our own reactive responses in that moment. So already, it's important to recognize what our own ego tendencies are, especially if they're less visible. And while we could say that, oh, a strong ego might lead someone to, you know, be driven, take charge, I think that may get that person ahead in the short term, but it doesn't really build safety in an organization. It doesn't build trust, doesn't build camaraderie. It creates a fear of judgment. And across a team or across an organization, in essence, when we feel unsafe, we feel the need to protect ourselves. And if I'm protecting myself, I'm focused on protecting myself. I'm not focused on the mission. I'm not focused on learning. I'm not focused on collective problem solving. And so we end up having a lot of organizations, and you know, we're going to say, oh, it's the culture or politics. But really what it is many people who feel in danger and then are kind of spinning out whatever their survival strategies are. And part of what we try to get at in the book, and we have a little chapter called, or it's not a chapter, it's a section in a chapter called The Dollar Cost of the Ego System. Because it's not a small problem. When leaders of organizations that are very large and need to be collaborating with each other don't get along, and when that breakdown spirals into their teams, there's basically not much good happening. And so I peg it more as it's like 30 to 40% of your NOI every year is being lost to ego dynamics because we're doing duplicitous work. We're working around each other. We're actively not committed to things that your group proposed to me. It really it's pretty detrimental. And so my whole mission from a sort of business perspective is to help create ego-free environments where I'm not protecting myself from you, you're not protecting yourself from me, and together we're actually thinking about what is this larger cause that we're trying to create.
So in order to keep that your ego in check and making sure that you're operating in a better place, any tips that you can give to a new leader that can help them as they're coming into a new leadership role? I think we've talked with a number of leaders and they say, you know, that the problem is you don't want to let people know that you don't know everything. And that's one of the things that, you know, people try to fake their way until they are discovered, or hope they're not discovered. But any tips that you can give to a new leader just to lead from a different place?
Well, just on the point you were raising there, when we don't know what we're doing, you better believe that other people know that. Like, they see it. And so if you think about, if you've had someone who reports to you and you see they're struggling and they don't talk to you about their struggles, does that reassure you or does that make you worried? It makes me worried.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. And when they say, oh, I'm stuck with this issue, or I feel like I'm struggling here, I don't know how to do this. As a leader, I think we feel enormous relief. Oh my God. Okay. This person is self-diagnosing their issue. We can talk about it. Whereas if I'm thinking it, but you're not bringing it up, I have this whole barrier to go through to kind of name this thing, you know? And so that actually, not admitting what we don't know or what we're struggling with is really a huge barrier, because other people see it. And if we don't admit it or we're trying to cover it, I think it actually causes them to judge us. Whereas if we're authentic about what we're struggling with, it actually, and vulnerable, I think, is a term that gets used a lot. I think one of the purposes of vulnerability, or one of the benefits of vulnerability, is that it actually generates empathy in other people. So if I reveal to you something that I'm struggling with, I think the sort of natural mammalian response is to want to help. And so we actually invite people in when we're vulnerable. I'll just make a little remark. Admitting vulnerability is different than spiraling in self-judgment. That's not admitting vulnerability. That's a different type of ego mechanism where people are so harshly critical of themselves that no one else dares say anything to us. So that's different than admitting simply that I don't know. So I think that's a big one. Yeah, I mean, I suppose we could go in many different directions here. One thing that just comes to mind around your question, I think, would be to really be wary of when you judge other people. Because judgment is the go-to defense mechanism of our ego. And we can always find things to judge other people on. You know, that they're not competent at this, or they have these intentions. And judgment really goes with conflict avoidance, meaning you do something as my colleague, I don't really say something to you about it, but I kind of note it. And then I start having conclusions, I have confirmation bias, and then there's just this gap in our relationship. And when we judge, it really gives us psychological benefits. I may feel victimized by how you're behaving, but I also feel superior. And I feel righteous. And I feel like it's not my fault that things are going wrong. And when I judge, I try to remind myself, okay, if I'm judging right now, it's because my ego is afraid. How am I afraid right now? At what moment did I start feeling in danger? Did I start feeling judged? Did I start judging myself? It has really to do, this is our lens, it has everything to do with my self-worth in my own eyes. And I just see how when I'm feeling incompetent in some way, struggling with something that's difficult for me, if I start avoiding that, not very long after, I'll start judging somebody. And I'll maybe judge myself, but I'll also be judging other people. And that causes disconnection in our teams. And it cuts us off from our greatest human resource, which is other people. Our ability to mutually support. So those would be two thoughts for initial leaders.
Now, I know most of the book is talking about those relationships at work and kind of on the corporate side. You mentioned that some of the biggest challenges are being a parent and helping our kids. Anything that you can talk to, some tools that you use with your kids as far as around helping them and
Oh, sometimes I think there's a book to do on this.
Yeah.
It's funny because I don't know if you'd be happy if I shared this, but my eldest son crashed our car on New Year's Eve. And he said to us later, to me and my wife also does this work with me. He said, "No, but you understand that our family is a little different, because I don't think any of my parents, my friend's parents, when I, you know, if they had crashed the car, would have both not only not been angry and not been trying to punish him, but would have been more with, wait, what's going on in your life right now that this happened? I don't like what's happening that, you know, what is this a symptom of?" So I just mentioned again, and I don't know that I responded in the right way in that moment, but I think it's indicative of how vigilant I try to be around my judgments, around me diagnosing what I think is going on with my children. And part of my journey, I grew up in very angry households. So a lot of my journey as a father was actually learning how to process the triggers I had that caused me to be angry, because I really struggled with anger as an early father. And I think anger really severs connection, severs safety. Mm. And for me, it's all about, I'm angry at you because you did this, and not really being aware of, I don't know how to cope in this moment. I feel powerless because my two boys are fighting and I don't know how to resolve it. So I'm going to lash out at them. Like, it really comes back to our own vulnerability, not processing and owning our own vulnerability, and therefore acting out in some way. Mm. So in all of that, we have a practice. If I can say other things, but one other thought, because I know I'm not supposed to go on forever on each topic, but we have a tool that we propose at LAL. It has an acronym. It's a TIRP, TIRP, and it's when you're introducing a delicate conversation, to start with, here's a topic I want to talk about. And then images has to do with the idea of dreaded images. Like, here's how I'm afraid of appearing in this moment. Here's what I'm afraid I might look like, what you might think of me. R is for reaction. So when I have these a dreaded image is a self-worth fear. It has to do with what are you going to think about me? Then causes me to have certain coping strategies. And the P stands for purpose. What actually is my purpose right now? And I was just talking with someone yesterday, you know, so we teach this to business teams and executives. And I was saying, but I use this all the time with my children. Because as a father, if I come in to talk to my child about homework or screen time or, you know, what's going on with their car, they're immediately primed to feel judged. They're immediately kind of in danger with the authority that we have as a parent, you know, and so they're on alert. And it's easy for me to sort of feel a little agitated with what they're doing and come in with a little bit of extra aggression. And so we just get, and this is how we get teenage crises, right? Because we get sort of in headbutting contests. And so I use this tool on a regular basis. I'll tell my children, okay, I want to talk about this. I'm afraid of coming across as authoritarian or judgmental or like I know better. And so I'd rather just avoid the conversation. But I don't know any better than you, right? We're making this up as we go along, but my goal is really to sort of be connected with you, support you, and try to just sort through and see what's going to be best for your life long term. So I'm just role playing an example, but I use that tool on a regular basis in order to set up a difficult conversation and then get into it. And the one other addendum I would add to that is never try to address an issue when it's happening. So my kid is drinking, my kid is acting out if they're younger, if they're on the screen time, they're probably feeling bad that they're doing it, and I'm feeling bad that they're doing it. And so both of us are in our brainstems. It's the worst possible moment to try to resolve anything. But it's usually what we do. We don't talk about it when it's not happening, and then we lash out at each other when it is. And so my other big thing was never always address it away from the crisis. Take an appointment. Hey, there's something I'd like to talk about. It's a little delicate. When can we talk this weekend? What's good for you? Saturday afternoon. Okay. And then they come in ready, we come in ready, and we're centered. And we stand a much better chance of finding our way than if we're just, you know, nagging or lashing out in the moment of it.
So you've written books, and definitely encourage people to pick up. You've got at least two books that I'm aware of. others probably in the works, but any books that you recommend to other leaders that have been helpful?
Well, I will, right. So Ego-Free Leadership is a book, just since you opened the door, I'll mention, I also wrote a memoir called When the Running Began, which is much more of a sort of my coming of age experience, working through my trauma and my substance abuse. It's has a lot of our work fused into that. So that's a sort of a much more personal approach to our work, if that's relevant to anyone. I was thinking about books because it was one of your questions, and I'll just say that probably one of the filters in what I'm selecting has to do with what, like I've read many different books over the years about, you know, this topic or that topic. I was big into biographies, but if I think about the books that influenced my life, they have to do with books that created movement internally in me. Like, I think there's something about my journey that's around my own growth, my own inner state, and then bringing my work into the world. So one book that I felt really very moved by actually was Liz Gilbert's Big Magic. So she's much more known for Eat, Pray, Love, but she wrote an extraordinary book called Big Magic. And it is about the creative process. It's about fears and ego and finding your kind of creative inspiration and then nurturing that in daily life. And she, without really talking about ego, she really talks about moving beyond our ego. And it's a very accessible book. I would like read 3 pages and then need to pause because I felt like it was both so light and so dense at the same time that I had to take it in bite-sized chunks. So for anyone who's certainly has creative endeavors or is wanting to, bring something to fruition, I just can't recommend that book enough. She's really something else. On a totally different front, I have a dog-eared copy of Stephen Mitchell's translation of Tao Te Ching. And that I had tried to read that book several times and never really got anywhere. And his translation is really sparkling. It really gives access. And I found that interesting because it really is a very different approach than the Western sort of mindset I grew up with. So I just found that it often would help me just come at things from a little bit of a different perspective. And then maybe a last book was Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates. I think that book, as a white man, that book, I don't know that it helped me understand any the black experience, but it helped me briefly kind of get inside what it might feel like to exist in our world as a black man. And I think at the very least, when things come up today, I have a little spot in my brain where I'm like, I know I don't get it. So I'm curious as opposed to judgmental, by the way. So I really am grateful to him for his writing. I think he's really something else.
So any parting advice that you would give to new or up-and-coming leaders?
Well, one, life is really long. Life is long. You know, I mean, I'm 51 and I still got years to go. And I know that early on I was just in a rush, you know, to get ahead, to do this, to do that. And it's just, life is long. So one is just to be sort of patient and with the work you're doing now, as opposed to trying to get somewhere else, because there's not really a moment in the future where you're going to achieve happiness. There's only you accessing a feeling of wholeness and purpose today and connection today. The future doesn't really exist in that sense. There's not a moment like, oh, I got there. Now I feel it. Even now I'm constantly just trying to remember, be with my process now. And I think maybe another thing is don't focus too much on trying to achieve a specific vision. And I don't know how much this is personal to me versus other people, but I see that I often had ideas of what I wanted and it never turned out that way. In part because there's so much complexity in this world. There's so many things that come from other people and unexpected events. And what unfolds in many ways is so much out of our control that I more see it as surfing a wave than trying to control the ocean. And I think in that there's been so many moments where I've had unwanted setbacks, you know, failures, health issues, tragedies, where it was not what I wanted. And my, you know, it's like, why is this happening? I don't want this to happen. And it's actually often when I look back in those moments where I stayed present with the setback and I let go of my judgments and I sort of leaned in with a learning mindset and tried to understand what was happening or what was going on and how can I sort of make it good, that I've often come out of the back end of those experiences feeling like, wow, that was an incredible blessing. That gave me something that I didn't even know I needed and that is very meaningful. But if you had asked me on the front end, I would have said, I don't want that to ever happen. So, things are unexpected in that sense. So I guess embrace the challenges.
So how would somebody learn more about your work and your books, and what's the best way to learn more about you?
Well, we have my day job is at Learning as Leadership. So we are a boutique consulting firm that does 360 coaching and leadership seminars, culture change work. So we can look us up on the web to see our website. The work we do ends up being quite tailored. So usually the right way to get in touch with us is just to have a conversation and talk it through. Because as I've been trying to communicate here, my tendencies, your tendencies, a listener's tendencies are all very personal. And so the process ends up being quite tailored. I have had people that have written to us, saying that they had, written all over the margins of Ego Free Leadership and it really helped them grow in different ways. So I do hope that that's a book that in and of itself, even if you never contact us, can be meaningful to you.
Well, thanks, Shane. I definitely have enjoyed our conversation. I know it's going to be helpful and definitely encourage everybody to pick up your book. And I know it will make definitely an impact and hopefully how people lead their teams and their companies.
Well, thank you so much, Mark. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.